Hello, and welcome to Media Ministry at Holden Village. Today's date is August 2nd, 2004. Today's session number is SUK 2004-01. Today's speaker is Carla Zumala. And the lesson for today is Here I Am, Lord, Responding to Call in Jewish Literature and Tradition, Abraham, the Tragic. Let's listen in.
Handouts, and some of you may need to share. And what I've done, I don't know what I was thinking, but I did as a whole packet for the week. So you can either hold on to them, or if you are afraid that you won't remember it the next day, you can drop them off with me and I can keep passing them out. So whatever you feel comfortable with. And if you'd like your very own set to bring home, let me know, and I can certainly make copies of those. But keeping in mind trees, I didn't want to overdo it. So if people can grab some, and if you can share with the person next to you, that will
help. I'll share.
I also have some extra sheets of just the text that we're taking a look at today, so because I made those yesterday afternoon, just in case. The packet's got everything in it. This is a couple extra.
You want one of these? I could pick one of those because I can't be here.
Chance to look through these. And 9 o'clock is definitely a better time for me than 7:30. All right. Well, we're going to be, I have some of this on PowerPoint, so some of them will be referring to sheets, some of them I'll have up here. And so if some of these pictures look familiar, they are. I have my PowerPoints, and as we've been traveling on our way to get to Holden, we've been taking pictures so I can insert them in as background. So I'll have to see if I can find something for tomorrow. My husband said he saw a bear, and I was like, and where's the picture? He's like, what about me? I'm like, yeah. What we're going to be taking a look at this week is the theme we have for the summer, for looking at Holden, Summon Us Out. We're taking a look at, specifically in the context of this Bible study, Here I Am, Lord. It's a phrase that shows up a number of times in the Hebrew Bible, and we're going to be taking a look at what it means when it's being used. Why do people use it in the biblical text? When responding to God, when responding to others, and remarkably, God even uses this phrase. So we're going to talk a little bit about this week and try to examine and reflect on what it means to say this to God and what it means with respect to call. The new thing, and in Hebrew, the new thing is called the chidush. So if you want a new word for today, and that's always the important thing in a Jewish Bible study, you want to come out with the new thing. What we're taking a look at is the context, call in the context of Jewish literature and tradition. Often I'll refer to it as rabbinic, partly because at the same time Christianity emerged, the biblical religion of the Hebrews was fundamentally changed as well. And they were no longer called Israelites, but called rabbinic Jews, because worship was no longer focused around the temple, which was destroyed, but it was more focused on local communities with a rabbi and a synagogue. So in many ways, rabbinic Judaism, or the Judaism that you know of today, if you have Jewish friends, family members, or neighbors, the Judaism today is really a sister religion to Christianity. Christianity and this rabbinic Judaism really emerged at about the same time. It is a Judaism with which many Christians are not very familiar, however, in terms of the practices of biblical interpretation, tradition, that sort of thing. So what we want to take a look at this week is how our brothers and sisters in a neighboring community of faith look at call in these texts. After all, they've been looking at these texts as long as Christians have, longer perhaps, and we want to see what they can do to enrich our understanding, and also see if there are some new approaches or techniques that they can add to in terms of our arsenal of biblical interpretation and interpretive techniques. So here I am, Lord, responding to call in Jewish literature and tradition. I guess here's where I can do my advertisement for the Holden Bookstore. All right, this is the book on which I'm using, or which I'm using to do a lot of this study. It's called Hineni in Our Lives. Hineni is the Hebrew word phrase for here I am. All right. Learning How to Respond to Others Through 14 Biblical Texts and Personal Stories. It's by Norman J. Cohen, who is a faculty member and dean at Hebrew Union College in New York City. I am a graduate of Hebrew Union College on the Cincinnati campus, and I know Dr. Cohen, and I respect his work, and he's done a really good job of bridging scholarship and daily life sort of activities and reflection in this text. The first part is text study. The second part is a grouping of personal stories by noted Jewish thinkers, rabbis, scholars, professionals, who talk about how they discerned their own calls, which is kind of an interesting thing. I hadn't really read that before. I've read a lot about Christian sense of vocation and call, but I hadn't read a lot about how Jews discern call. And so in a lot of ways, there are a lot of parallels, and there are some interesting differences that can add to our understanding of call. This is kind of the underlying principle that we're going to be working with this week, and this isn't anything really new, but this is what underlies rabbinic or Jewish interpretation of the Bible, and much Christian interpretation as well. If the Bible is to have any authenticity, the attempt to find contemporary meaning in it must be grounded in the Bible itself. All right. So I think this is something that Martin Luther could easily agree with, and something that in the Christian community sometimes we take it for granted. But on the flip side, I think there is a lot going on today in the Christian community where sometimes the Bible is forgotten in terms of looking at what's going on in the biblical text and what a Christian life means. All right. So this is from the very outset of this text, Hineni in Our Lives. Oh, wrong button. The issue is, how do we find contemporary meaning in the Bible, all right? And that's kind of what our goal is. If the Bible is to have any validity for us, it has to connect to our own lives. And so that's what we're talking about, contemporary meaning. So what we're trying to figure out is, how do we find this contemporary meaning? According to the rabbis, we seek out, we search, we even demand the treasure that is to be found in the text. All right? Now, it's kind of interesting. We can probably agree with the seek out, maybe even the search, but this demand is kind of an interesting framing, a different interesting way of looking at the text. I know for my students, when I use words like that, demand something from the text, they see that as pretty presumptuous, and they're a little intimidated about doing that. And I think that's one of the things that Jewish rabbis can add to our reflection, in the sense that, yes, the Bible does demand to be taken seriously. It is, after all, the Word of God, and that we need to go at it with all seriousness. We need to be, in some ways, active and aggressive when we look at this biblical text. And we are entitled to demand the treasure which is in it. And we'll be talking a little bit about that. This process of seeking out, of searching, and even of demanding is called midrash. And it's from the verb darash in Hebrew. But the word that I'd like you to be familiar with this week is midrash. Many of you may have heard this word before. And midrash can refer to a type of literature. It can refer to a process. And it can even refer to a particular technique. It's kind of an all-encompassing term. But it basically involves searching out, seeking, demanding the treasure that is to be found in biblical texts. And that's kind of the frame of reference that we'll be using. In the background here, there are actually two pictures of the same thing. This is the New Seattle Public Library, which is an absolutely incredible facility. And I chose this because the rabbis have a metaphor for looking at Torah. Torah is another word for scripture. They say it's like a precious gem or a diamond. And what you do is turn it again, see how the light hits the different facets. And then once you've seen it, turn it again. And it's kind of like there's always something new to be found in Torah. And I thought this Seattle Public Library was a perfect way of representing that. Within this are these, you know, wealth of texts. And every time you look at that building, you're always at a different angle, and you're seeing it a new way, or the light hits in a different way, or you're from standing at a different perspective. And that's kind of what we're doing with Scripture. We're looking at it as if it is a diamond. And you turn it, and you turn it, and you turn it, to see what we find within it. What does midrash involve? Right. A couple of different things. Gaining familiar with the text and its context. All right. We need to know some of these stories. And the stories that we'll be taking a look at this week are familiar probably to many of you. Stories of Abraham, stories of Jacob, Moses, Samuel, and Isaiah. You probably won't see these as new texts. They're pretty standard Vacation Bible School fare. All right. So what we'll be trying to do is see what is to be found in these texts as adults and at different phases in our lives, and trying to figure out learn a little bit more about them. Midrash also involves benefiting from the past two millennia and more of biblical interpreters. With modern biblical scholarship, we've had a loss in some ways. Our emphasis has been so exclusively on what did the original authors intend? What did they mean in this text? Then we want to jump 2,000 plus years and say, what does it mean for me today? Well, in doing that, we miss out on people of faith and communities of faith who have wrestled with text for over 2,000 years and who have added their insights and added their questions and their answers and their struggles to this long, long discussion. Midrash takes that long discussion into account, and we want to be part of that discussion. So that involves the third point, entering into this conversation that has been going on for over 2,000 years. We are all equal participants in this conversation. There's nobody ahead of us, even if they have names like Augustine or Jerome or Akiva, who's better than we are. We are all looking at this text, and our voices are all valid. And it's as if we can talk to these characters and these figures in history and kind of question them, have them question us, respond to them, have them respond to us. We want to enter into this process. And that's part of what we'll be doing this week in looking at some of these biblical texts. More specifically, what we're going to be doing this week is claiming our roles as active readers, right? We're active participants. The biblical text is not a static text that, you know, is forever and always just one thing. We're going to try to look at it as a more dynamic sort of thing and see ourselves engaging it, all right? What this involves is asking questions. Now, I don't know what kind of tradition you grew up in or what kind of tradition you happen to be in right now, but I grew up in a tradition that didn't encourage a lot of question asking. I became very, very familiar with the stories in my tradition and the text and its context. The questioning part, however, was held suspect. All right? The Bible was not something to be questioned. It was something to be memorized or learned or repeated, things like that. So this questioning is kind of an interesting thing. And when I talk to my students about that, they get kind of nervous. They say, well, how dare we question the Bible? And the point is not trying to question it to dismiss it. The point is to ask questions to get further involved in it. All right? We'll talk a little bit more about that as we go along. By the way, this question asking is something the rabbis made an art form out of. They have all kinds of different ways of asking and framing and posing questions. Some of them are difficult to understand. Some of them are downright humorous in terms of the way they look at text and ask questions. In your packet, I have an example at the back. If you take a look towards the end of the packet, there's a page that says, what is Midrash? All right. And this is just for your benefit to take a look at in terms of basic definitions of Midrash. And if you turn the page, you see Midrashic styles. All right. Go one further where it says skeptic. Does everybody find the page that says on the top, a Roman noble? All right. This is one example of rabbis asking questions within a Midrashic text, all right? And sometimes they do it in the form of a little dialogue. Here's a question that they're asking about the very beginning of the book of Genesis. And in this kind of framework, that one of the most common forms is to have a skeptic, who is generally some sort of Roman soldier or Roman noble, because the early rabbinic Jews were under Roman occupation in Palestine, and then to have a Jew, often a rabbi, and in this case, it's a rabbi's daughter answering the question. It's kind of an interesting way of doing it. A Roman noble said to Rabban Gamliel. Rabban Gamliel is one of the notable rabbis, and sometimes you'll see Rabban, sometimes you'll see Rabbi, depending on the title. He tells this rabbi, he says, your God is a thief, because after all, isn't it written in your very own text? And God made Adam sleep and took a rib. So he's looking at that text and says, your God's a thief. Takes a rib, makes Adam fall asleep, and takes his rib. All right. Rabban Gamliel's daughter said, let me respond to that. Let me answer. She said to him, give me a soldier. She could also have said here, give me a policeman. What for? He asked. She replied, robbers came last night and took this vase of silver and replaced it with a vase of gold. He said, I wish they would come every night. She answered, so isn't it proper that Adam had one rib removed and had it replaced with a woman? Rabbis know how to play with text. And sometimes, like I said, There could be a thousand different ways of answering that question, but taking a look at why a rib, was it an act of thievery or not? The rabbi, and so there's always a wealth of questions to be asked as we go through this. What we want to take a look at is, in the end, this is kind of what we're coming to. We discover that when we study the biblical text, what we are doing is not simply reading and analyzing the narrative and learning about the characters and their lives. Rather, we find ourselves confronting our own baffling life dramas. Torah, or scripture, is a mirror. It reflects back to us our own personas, ambivalences, struggles, and potential for growth. Ultimately, engaging in this text, asking these questions, immersing ourselves in Torah, tells us more about who we are in relationship to our God and our neighbor. And that's kind of our investigation this week. This citation is from the Hineni book in the introduction. Why are we asking questions? What's the big deal about questions? Is it good to ask questions just for their own sake? Generally, the point of questions is to search for some sort of meaning. In this midrashic process that we are going to enter, we must be willing to ask every meaningful question. What does that mean? Every question that comes to mind about that text is relevant, and it's meaningful to you. There's a sorting process that we can go through and say, maybe I don't want to ask that one right now, or maybe this one is more important. But every question is meaningful that you have about that text. We must risk asking the most difficult questions. Now, I think this is interesting. I added the word risk. I had first put we must be willing to ask the most difficult, but that's not, I don't think, accurate. Asking difficult questions is a risk, because sometimes we find answers that we really don't want. And I think that that's kind of something that it is a risk-taking venture. It's easy to ask more superficial questions where the answer, whatever it is, doesn't mean a whole lot to us or won't affect us in any particular way. Or a question to which we already at least know part of the answer. But asking difficult questions, questions to which we have no idea what kind of answer there might be and how that answer might affect us, is a risk. And that's part of what biblical study involves. Well, the text that we're going to be taking a look at today is Genesis 22, and the character Abraham, and this tragic sense of call. You can turn back to the first sheet of your packet. Now, just to introduce this phrase that we're using, Hineni, as I indicated, and you'll see the translation throughout, it simply means, here I am, or in older translations, here am I. It is not a verb, it's kind of a funny Hebrew word, Hineni. It's sort of, and it can mean a whole lot of different things. Hine is kind of if there's a technical term for it, it's called a deictic particle. Not something you need to know, but it's basically a particle that points, kind of like right here, you know, a big arrow. You know, have you been to restaurants where it's somebody's birthday and they bring out the big arrow and, you know, they sing happy birthday pointing to that person? I have it. It was very embarrassing. But it's like that here she is sort of thing. Here, right here. So it's clear to everybody involved. And that he named me, ani is the second part of it. Me, here I am, my whole being. So this he named me takes into it a huge breadth of meaning, as most Hebrew words do. I call the language economical, all right? There isn't a large vocabulary, so each word that there is needs to encompass an awful lot and be used in many different ways. So this term hineni, here am I, here I am, indicates some sort of readiness, preparedness, willingness, right? Availability. All those sorts of things are in that small phrase, hineni. And it's a word you'll become very familiar with this week. Now, it appears 14 times in the Old Testament or Hebrew Bible in this context of here I am. And with some of our most famous characters in the biblical text, as I noted, Abraham, Moses, Samuel, people like this. And what we're going to examine is where this phrase, this word, appears and how is it used in the context of call. And when characters in the biblical text say, here I am, we want to ask, what is it that they're saying? What does that say to us in terms of our response to call? Now, it's kind of interesting, we should note that this hineni, here I am, can be a response to a call from God, to a call from another, like a parent or a friend. It can also be a response that God uses when people call out to God. So God also says, hineni. We'll get to that by Friday, and it seems kind of remarkable to me that God would say, here I am, available, ready, willing, prepared in response to God's people. So we'll take a look at the range of how this term is used and how it fits into our discernment of call as people of God. Now, the first thing I'd like to take a look at is this text. All right, we're going to start at Genesis 22, verse 1, and it's on the sheet that you have, or if you have your biblical text, that's fine, and either way. And we're going to take a look at verses 1 through 12. The chapter goes on, continues a little bit beyond this, but this is the key passage that we're going to be examining this morning. Starting with verse 1. After these things, God tested Abraham. He said to him, Abraham, and he said, here I am. He said, take your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah, and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains that I shall show you. So Abraham rose early in the morning, saddled his donkey, and took two of his young men with him, and his son Isaac. He cut the wood for the burnt offering and set out and went to the place in the distance that God had shown him. On the third day, Abraham looked up and saw the place far away. Then Abraham said to his young men, stay here with the donkey. The boy and I will go over there. We will worship, and then we will come back to you. Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on his son Isaac. And he said to him, and he himself carried the fire and the knife. So the two of them walked on together. Isaac said to his father, Abraham, father. And he said, here I am, my son. He said, the fire, the wood are here, but where is the lamb for a burnt offering? Abraham said, God himself will provide the lamb for a burnt offering, my son. So the two of them walked on together. When they came to the place that God had shown him, Abraham built an altar there and laid the wood in order. He bound his son Isaac and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. Then Abraham reached out his hand and took the knife to kill his son. But the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. And he said, here I am. He said, do not lay your hand on the boy or do anything to him. For now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. It's a pretty powerful passage. Kierkegaard has examined this passage and found it to be one of fear and trembling. Kierkegaard agonized about this passage. What kind of God would demand this sort of sacrifice? What kind of father would follow through on this sort of sacrifice? Or be willing to follow through? Difficult questions that emerge from this passage. I have some questions on the back of the sheet, and the first thing I'd like to do sort of as a warm-up exercise as we kind of immerse ourselves and engage in this midrashic process is try to figure out what is it that you'd like to know about this passage? One of the things that always I'm a little disappointed in is that the Bible does not have footnotes. Yes, we have editors who put them in, but the original authors and God did not add footnotes. I'd like some explanation here and there. Maybe a date once in a while, you know, a geographical marker, and, you know, perhaps a reference. There aren't any. And there are a lot of things that we might kind of wonder about. In taking a look at this passage, letter by letter, word for word, sentence by sentence, because that's what the rabbis did. Do you know that they looked at each and every letter in the Torah or in the scripture and found even in its shape something remarkable and a message from God? They saw levels and layers of meaning in every aspect of it. They said, if this text is from God, then it has to be infinite in meaning. It is a well that to which the bottom can never be found. So that's kind of what we're taking a look at. And then they wanted to mine those resources. So when we look at this story, what is it in this brief passage? What else would we like to know? What might be missing? What might be missing in this?
What the child was saying.
Yeah, what was Isaac thinking in all of this? That's part of Midrash, looking at a text through new eyes, a set of different eyes, like perhaps another character in the story. What if Isaac were to tell this story? Let's say it was Isaac was the narrator here. How might this story begin? Well, you know, we're not clear as to how old Isaac was. Some interpreters say 12, some say as old as 37. Now, if he's 37, I see some problems there, but... But at that rate, let's go with the 12-year-old Isaac, all right? So one August morning, my dad woke up early and rustled me out of my tent and said, son, we've got to go. All right, so we went with two of our servants and we headed out. And, you know, he said we were going to do a sacrifice, but, and usually when we do them, because we do them fairly often, we have some sort of ram or lamb, you know, a goat perhaps. We didn't have anything like that. We had firewood, and we had fire, and we had some rope, and we had our kits, you know, our backpacks. No sacrifice. You know, you kind of hear him telling it from that point of view, all right? Finally, you know, Isaac at the point of being tied to the altar. Dad, like, what are you doing? Dad? What kinds of questions might emerge from that? Think about his relationship with his father.
That's what I wonder about. What kind of relationship did he have with his father prior?
You know, we don't know,
It also seems to me, I may be wrong, but during this time they had a lot of fertility cults, and child being sacrificed was common in that day, especially for the first child.
So there would have been neighbors who did this, but in this instance, you know, you take a look at the context of Isaac. This is the only child that they had in old age. Would it have been foolish to sacrifice, you know, this child in particular? But yeah, you're right. So maybe, you know, that's part of it.
But would that be why, what I miss in the very beginning is why Abraham didn't question, or it doesn't give us any clue that Abraham agonized over this or any aspect, but he just, I mean, he had, as you pointed out, he had already said, here I am before, but then we don't get anything except the next morning he starts off.
And you know, if Abraham was the type of character not to question in general, that might make more sense. But think about it. We've just emerged just a few chapters before, chapter 18. What did he do for Sodom and Gomorrah? He bargained. He bargained hard. It goes on and on. Far be it from me, he says. But what if there are just 20? Well, what if there are just, you know, I hate to bother you. He goes on and on and on. This is a man who bargains with God. He doesn't seem to have any problem there. Why doesn't he bargain for his son?
I always wondered if Abraham knew it was a test. Because when Isaac asks him, he says, well, God will provide the lamb. As if he already knew that ultimately Isaac wouldn't be sacrificed, that God just wanted to see his devotion.
Yeah. Is it? Does he know it's a test? Is he? Is he? Does he? Is he like super old? Is he like oblivious? It's like, okay, Sonny, we're heading off to the mountain. Like, did he know? Yeah.
A little trivia here. I wonder if this is what we call a white lie, when Abraham says in verse 5, stay here, he says to his servants, we will worship, and then we will come back.
That's a rabbinic question. The rabbis really had a lot of trouble with that. What is he lying? Does he know they'll come back? Who's the we? Some people posit, because if you take a look at the end of the story, at the end of Genesis 22, there is no mention of Isaac going back. Yeah. Because you have Abraham going, it's not in this one, but if you look at the biblical text, there is no mention of Isaac. So, yeah, it is. Is he lying there? Is he saying, it'll be all right, kid, come on, it will, you know, sort of thing, or to the servants? Does he not want to alarm them? But yeah, what does that mean? Does he know what's going on?
But it's not a test if he wouldn't go through with it.
Yeah, that's the thing. Or you mean if he knows?
If he knows.
Yeah, it's not a test then.
It's not a test then. No, it's just a charade or something.
Right. Yeah, is this kind of like, yeah, sure, it's that the sacrifice show.
If Isaac didn't come back, would that have been the end of Jewish faith?
Well, take a look at it. When we say often this has been called the ultimate sacrifice, and that means ultimate in many more ways than we can think of today. My students in class will often say, well, you know, Isaac would eventually see Abraham in heaven and they'd be together again. Well, I've got a little trouble with that. In these days, there was no concept of heaven or hell or even an afterlife in the way that we understand it today. How did you live on? Through your children. So whether or not, in the earlier session this morning, somebody said, maybe Isaac was a teenager and his dad had gotten really sick of him. Even if that's the case, he still needed to keep him alive, because that is how Abraham would live into the future. So sacrificing Isaac wasn't just sacrificing a child, as terrible as that would be. It was sacrificing his present as well as his future for eternity. All right? Yep.
Yeah, I just see the layers and layers in order that they have gone through in order to have this child.
Yeah.
You know, they're sacrificing more than that. They're sacrificing a promise. You know?
That's exactly it. That's the promise. It's the child. It's Abraham's future. It's the promise of a nation. Remember Genesis 12 at the very first three verses. I will make a great nation of you. There's a lot going on, huh?
We look at that. Well, here is the negative side of this.
Mm-hmm.
But what's the other side? Abram's faith is so great that he will argue with God. He knows he's loved. He knows he can have a discussion, same as our own children will argue with us when they know that we're likely to change our mind.
Mm-hmm.
And I see this more as a trust case.
So he's trusting, but he's not arguing here.
He's not arguing in the side of the from Abraham. Abraham's not arguing with God, mm-hmm. because he trusts God. He knows this is not something, you can't argue with this. I think as an adult, if we look at this from the perspective that this is our child, if we don't have faith enough to trust God in these cases, what do we do? We have to turn our back on God entirely. That's a really... that's where I think the line is, God will provide.
God will provide.
Key to this thing.
And I think you're right. I think part of it, though, in our daily lives with our children, with our relationships, and with our calls, is it that clear to us, that call and that trust? And I don't know that it was, by saying that Abraham knew and he was absolutely certain, we're putting him on another level than we ourselves are. Abraham was a person, flesh and blood like you and I. And that's what we're trying to imagine, these doubts or these struggles in the face of a call like that. Because I don't know that Abraham was a superhuman. There's nothing in the biblical text that said he was divine in any way. And I think that's kind of that sort of thing. Instead of pushing him away from us, we're trying to get closer to what he might have been thinking. even though he was willing ultimately to do it. We're trying to imagine that context to see how we can, what kinds of struggles that he might have been having in this. And that, I think you brought up a good question in terms of which caused me to think, how did Abraham know that it was God? How did Abraham know that it was God? Yep.
Well, I don't know the answer to that. They'd say, well, you have an excuse because you're mentally ill.
Mentally ill. You know, there's a case that happened in the 90s, late 90s, in California. A man says that God told him to sacrifice his youngest daughter. He did. He said that it was a clear call from God. He killed his daughter and went on trial. And this was the defense that he used. The jury was in the position of deciding, was it murder, or was it insanity? Or was it, and the third possibility, what do you do in an American jury? We don't have a category in our legal code, call from God to murder child. Yeah, difficult. How do you know that it's God? What, how, because Abraham says, after these things God tested Abraham, he said to him, Abraham, and he, Abraham, said, here I am. How did Abraham know that it was God? He's talked to him before. There's a relationship. There's relationship. God did not ask this ultimate thing of Abraham the first time they met. Although that first time they met, it wasn't such a good request either. Take your family, take your wife, take your cattle, take your servants, and go to the land which I'm showing you. I just won't tell you which one it is yet. Although that's not as bad as a sacrifice. All right?
Kind of a forgotten figure in this whole thing is Sarah. What is she thinking about this whole thing?
Yeah.
She's in the dark.
You think about it. Okay, I don't have children. I have a niece and nephew that I love dearly. But let me tell you, if I was 93 years old and I had a baby, I would want some say in this whole matter. This woman did quite the thing. We're looking at her age. And to have Isaac taken out from, without a word, what would she have said to this whole thing? Go, fine, honey, if you think he needs to be sacrificed.
I bet he didn't tell her.
He didn't tell, yeah. Can you imagine? That's it, exactly. You know, what might she have thought?
Well, she would have, she was kind of manipulative. I mean, she did the whole thing with Hagar and Ishmael, and so she would have done some messing around there. She wouldn't have just let this happen.
And she laughed at God. Yes, she wasn't really, she went, exactly. So she, this is not a timid woman, no, is what we're saying. So maybe she would, so Abraham thought, best to get out before she knows.
They got up early.
I think, get your peanut butter and jelly. Yeah, exactly.
Is there anything to lead us to believe that he would think that God would resurrect his son if he killed him?
There was no such thing at that point in terms of resurrection. There, you know, it's possible, but there's nothing from the context or the text that or itself that would suggest that in terms of something that was going on in the society. What was likely happening in the surrounding society was child sacrifice. All right, so that is a possibility because it is not, was certainly not unknown. There is debate as to how common it was, but it certainly was part of that surrounding culture.
Isn't this kind of a God image of intolerance because he just hit the Sodom and Gomorrah guys? I would be, after he hit a whole city and destroyed him, he said, hey, get up and kill your kid. It's like the ultimate threat. Hey, we took out a whole city. If you don't do this, I'm going to wipe you out.
There's not a love.
It doesn't look very tolerant at all.
You know, one of my students once said, because I asked, what kind of God do these early chapters of Genesis, Genesis 12 through 22, especially 22, you know, 18, what kind of picture of God is it? And this kid said, kind of like the mob boss on Sopranos. Somebody you want on your side, but you don't want to get too close to. And it's kind of like that. You don't want to get on the bad side. All right? And, it's, you know, you kind of take a look at this. This is a pretty powerful God. And so, you know, I hadn't thought of that. It's like, okay, you wiped out some cities here. I guess I better, you know, what else could there be to wipe out?
We're going
to
be nasty.
Exactly. Or, you know, a God who can do what God wants to do.
Yeah. Well, I'm wondering how many people have God call you by name and say, go here, or do this, or, I mean, it's like, he very specifically, or God very specifically said, Abraham, and Abraham said, here I am. Here I am.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. And, you know, did you notice that he says, here I am, before the request came? And what did we say here I am means? I'm ready, I'm willing, I'm available. A good way of translating it is at your service. He's placing himself at God's disposal before he even knows what's going on. And I think that has to do with that whole issue of relationship that you pointed out already. They've got something. Regardless of the type of relationship that they have a history together. All right? So,
Just because I think of parents and kids, the answer to the call from mom, for the ones who trust mom is, what can I do? And the ones who don't is, what?
I tried this out on some camp counselors at the beginning of this summer, and I said, so think of yourselves. I said, now none of you would do this. I said, think of your younger brothers and sisters. When your parents say, you know, Jason, Cindy, do you say, here I am? What is the response? And what they say is, what? If you have kids, maybe you know that response. What? Or, mom. Yeah. You know, that there's the tone, apparently, that figures in. But it's not the at your service sort of thing. And it's kind of an interesting framework. But Abraham says, at your service, I am ready, I am willing, before he even knows what's going to happen. Which is kind of an interesting placement of that text. Any other sorts of things that are unusual?
Well, this is a question. Mm-hmm. I have the feeling we have an Old Testament God and a New Testament God. And the Old Testament God said in verse 12, now I know that you fear God. And in our culture today, we've sort of moved from scaring people into heaven with the hellfire and brimstone to God is love. Mm-hmm. And so some of us would be more comfortable hearing or reading, now I know that you love God. Mm-hmm. What does the Old Testament Hebrew say on this?
Well, I think first of all, one thing I would like to say is that I don't really see two gods. I think the God of the Old Testament is the same God of the New Testament, but the God of the New Testament, yet a further revelation, an expanding of who that God is. But I don't think they're fundamentally different, and I think that makes us as moderns very uncomfortable. About the Hebrew in terms of that term fear, as I mentioned, Hebrew is very economical language. Fear today has negative connotations. I'm afraid, I'm threatened, I'm fearful. In Hebrew, it has a much wider sense, including awe or encompassing awe, recognition. And the afraid sort of fear. It's a much bigger word. So it's kind of like, I recognize you as the creator of the universe. I am in awe of you as the creator of the universe. I'm also, like the mob boss on Sopranos, a little afraid of you as the creator of the universe. So it can be all of those sorts of things in that one word. But I think it's an important thing that you've pointed out, that fear in the limited sense that we use it today doesn't tell the whole story. And I think when Abraham says it, he's actually saying a whole lot more.
Did you have a comment? It just struck me in your comments on what that meant, here I am at your service, Lord, mm-hmm. that it's kind of interesting that Abraham says the same thing to his son Isaac in this particular setting and situation.
Isn't that interesting? We've got it a couple times here. We have here I am three times in this passage. And I'd like to point out that this is, in fact, the very first time that Hineni, here I am, appears in the Old Testament or Hebrew Bible, chapter 22. God has talked to Adam, God has talked to Noah, God has talked to other characters. This is the very first time that Hineni, here I am, is used. It's kind of interesting that it would be used in this sort of request or demand. So something to keep in mind. But yeah, we have, as I mentioned at the outset, this Hineni, here I am, is not necessarily a response to a God-human sort of call. what does it mean when "here I am" is placed in the context of father and son? Any ideas about that? When it's placed in the context of father and son? Uh-huh.
It's so similar, because when my child yells, "Mom," I'm like, "Here I am."
Exactly. And what do you mean by that?
What do you need? What is it?
What do you need? What is it? Kind of the more at your, you know, not, you don't want to say at your service sort of thing, but yeah, I'm ready.
No.
But this, yeah, that's what, yeah, you, what do you need?
Ready. What is it?
It's what
a
is
trust.
It? It's a trust. It looks as if there's a deep trust there. That relationship that God and Abraham seem to have looks like it's mirrored in that relationship between Abraham and Isaac.
It's also responsibility, though. Mm-hmm. We recognize as parents. Kids don't recognize the responsibility, but I mean, the parents, we recognize the responsibility, which is the same responsibility that God has for us, for providing them, to provide everything we need.
So that whole idea of "hineni, here I am" can also imply responsibility. We'll see with other characters that, like Samuel, who respond as children, that it may not have the same idea of responsibility, but you're right, it has to have that issue of responsibility. It has, and as you noted, there is something there. Yes, this is my son for whom I am responsible.
Mm-hmm. You know, it just strikes me on a human level as a parent, every day I pray for my children to protect them, that God would protect them. And it's like Luther talks about the affectum, kind of the assault of God, mm-hmm. you know, at some point. And here, Abraham, mm-hmm. you know, thinking of that protection of a child, his only child, it's unbearable for me to think of what it must mean for a parent who loses a child. I mean, I can't imagine that grief that they carry to the grave, because it's not supposed to be that way.
And talking about that responsibility is also a burden as well. It's kind of like the flip side of that responsibility, the grief that can go, the two sides of responsibility.
They carry that to their grave.
You know, and, yeah.
We keep talking about Isaac as his only son, but he has another son.
Yes, the rabbis have mentioned that. Take a look at verse 2.
I mean, Abraham's known for trying to work the system. Say, "You're my sister, Sarah."
Exactly. A couple of times.
You know, is he thinking, well, okay, I may have to sacrifice this son, but I do have that backup one.
I have a backup son. Oh, my God.
So, no, I mean not that. But
true.
His future will continue. It is, I mean, that thing he's asked to sacrifice is God's promise.
Take a look at verse 2, and the rabbi said the same thing, because they were well aware. We've already met Ishmael earlier on in this story, who is certainly a son. Some of my students in my class will say, well, he was an illegitimate son. There wasn't really that sense then. He was considered Abraham's flesh and blood, and there wasn't sort of that bastard child connotation. He was a legitimate son. Perhaps not the son that God was talking about, as you mentioned the promise, but certainly a legitimate son. So take a look at verse 2. God says, take your son, number one, your only son, Isaac, the one who you love. Is that overdoing it? Your son gives the name, the one who you love, your own. Wait a second. The rabbi's like, why did he have to identify that son in four different ways? And the rabbis play on that. They say, they show a dialogue between Abraham and God. God says, Abraham, take your son. Abraham says, which one? God says, Isaac. Abraham says, you know, and then God says, the one that you love. Abraham says, I love both of them. Abraham said, you know, so it kind of is this play back and forth. Which son, you know, the one whom you love? And the rabbis wondered, why did it need such explanation there to identify the son? And interestingly enough, especially in a passage that is so spare, there's so little detail in general that it's interesting that so much of it is used in that one phrase.
Mm-hmm. We also don't know how long it had been since he'd seen Ishmael at this point.
No idea. That's true.
Mm-hmm. And we don't, the person, I mean, Abraham is not writing this. God is not writing this. somebody.
A narrator.
Narrator wrote it who was not present. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's kind of interesting, though, that they chose, even so, with that sort of framing, to emphasize that. Was there some sort of issue with Isaac?
Is it possible that your could be plural here, talking about yours and Sarah's son?
Actually, not in Hebrew. It's a pretty clear singular. That's the nice thing about Hebrew. You can tell what it is, and it is addressing Abraham. So interesting possibilities. Got a few more minutes. Are there any other gaps? I would like to point your attention to the third use of Hineni. What do you notice in verse 11? That's different than the other two times.
It was the angel talking.
The angel was talking. And what else?
It says the name twice.
Abraham, Abraham. And we're going to see that pattern continue to surface. Abraham, Abraham. Samuel, Samuel. Jacob, Jacob. Over and over again. Moses, Moses. All right? Why twice? Why would he call, and it was, as you noted, the messenger or angel of the Lord, why would he call Abraham twice there?
Why the mother?
If
I really want to get their attention,
I'm going to wait. The rabbis respond in that same way. They suggest that perhaps Abraham is now so immersed in his task.
I really want to get their attention.
And so focused that it requires this double call. And that, and kind of like, you know, wake up, sort of, you know, because Abraham, having taken on this responsibility, this burden, is so focused on carrying it through that he's not even aware of any possibilities out there. And this double call is kind of like urgency. Whenever you see that, there is a definite sense of urgency in the text, some sort of alarm sounding.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the knife is already raised.
The knife is
so
raised.
So if you want to stop someone and stop them immediately, you're not going to stay at just once, probably.
Exactly. The critical point.
Uh-huh. It's like using your child's middle name. I'm convinced Abraham didn't have a middle name.
Exactly. Could have been something else, you know, Abraham, Mordecai, cut it out. So, you know, just that sense of that double call. The rabbis have an interesting story on that two double name. They say that Abraham had the knife poised, the fire was ready to be, you know, go on to that, the wood, the kindling, and this double call comes, and Abraham says, wait a second. God told me to sacrifice my son. Now he only sends a messenger to tell me to stop. I want to hear from the big chiefs. And so that's what they say. That's why the double call was there. And that he wants to hear it directly from the top that he should stop. Because he said, how do I know that I should stop? If God told me to do this in the first place, now a messenger comes along and says I shouldn't, who should I believe?
Uh-huh. It does also a question. Mm-hmm. Why would God send a messenger?
Exactly.
Why didn't God send? I'm not going to tell my son, go tell your daughter, my daughter, to stop doing something.
Exactly. People say, why the messenger? At the most critical point in the text, because after all, God's talked to Abraham before, why at that moment a messenger? It's kind of funny, yeah.
Well, I don't know about you, but if I'm doing something I don't want to do, I'm a lot easier to convince to not do that.
Okay. So that might be a possibility. So if he's doing something he doesn't, and that could be a possibility too. In some ways, yeah, and we don't know what was necessarily going on. Either Abraham was looking for an out, or, like I said, he might have been so immersed that he, you know, kind of like when you're doing something, the other possibility when you're doing something you don't want to do, you've got yourself so geared up that nothing's going to stop you at a certain point. It's like, fine, I'm going to go through with this.
Are we to assume that he also saw this messenger, or are we to assume that only in hearing he was able to differentiate that there was...
Yeah, not clear, not clear. And also that would beg the question again. You know, God can appear, we know that. Remember the burning bush, and that'll come up later, but it's not as if God doesn't have a record. God walks in the Garden of Eden. So we've got some, you know, figures of God appearing. But yeah, how does this appearance take place? Now, Jewish legend questions whether or not Abraham went a little overboard at the sacrifice and said, you know, I got this far, I'm at least going to shed a drop of blood. And so just to prove that I can do it, I really want to prove it. And so there is that tradition of shedding a drop of blood, and that has to do with the origins, perhaps, of circumcision. There are some legends tied in there.
Mm-hmm. We often read too much into things. There's a very simple explanation. The second Abraham was louder than the first because he's an old man and his hearing is going.
Very possible, very possible. He didn't have his ear horn on, you know. Very possible. You know, and the rabbis would come up with something with things like that too. All of these answers are possible and they add to the richness of the text.
Or did the angel come between him?
I don't know. Because it says an angel emerged and Abraham had to look at the bush, you know. And that's kind of a funny thing, like, you know, rams are not like chipmunks. I mean, how would this thing be just sort of sitting there in the bush until an opportune moment? You know, you kind of wonder. Legend has it that this place where Isaac was nearly sacrificed later became the location of the temple in Jerusalem. Or, you know, so this was the original location. Certainly not provable, but it's an interesting idea that in Jewish symbolism and tradition, and probably in the, important for Christians, the understanding of people like Paul in the New Testament probably very likely assumed things like that in his understanding of biblical text. Take a look at the second side. I have some questions there. There are a couple things that we've already talked about, but I'd like you to take a look and reflect on some of these questions, particularly when you're taking a look at responding to God in difficult circumstances or under requests and demands that aren't particularly ones that we want to hear, and using this perhaps as a way of informing our own lives and taking a look at with our relationship with God, as well as this passage alludes to the relationship between father and son. What we're going to be talking about as we go on through this week, that call has to do with our relationship to the other, whether that relationship be God or the person sitting next to you, your spouse, somebody at work. We often hear call through the voice of someone that we know. And in that case, we see that with Abraham and Isaac, that relationship between them. So we want to take a look at this response, here I am, and build on it this week, and to see who calls, who responds, what does that mean, right? I'll conclude our session this morning with a good rabbinic saying that can kind of set the tone this week as we discuss this together, as well as individually and in the cafeteria. The rabbis say, get yourself a study partner, find yourself a teacher, and study Torah. And so that is the their guiding principle in learning. Have a good day.
Thank you. Thank you.